day before the season prediction time. All of the season previews are in the rearview mirror. Danny is back to join us for the foreseeable future, I think. And it's time to talk about this season, but I've had a chance to do some of my predictions on the season previews. You haven't yet. We've got a lot of stuff to get to. We want to talk about MVP, playoffs, all that stuff. And then also League Cutdown Day had a lot of surprises. We're going to go through that as well. We're sponsored today by Blue Apron. Find out more about them at blueapron.com/capspace. You can get your first three meals free at Blue Apron by going to that blueapron.com/capspace link. How you doing, man? You ready for the season?
I'm so ready for the season. I mean, you and I both really enjoy the offseason. I think the disparity between the two is probably less for us than most people, but the season is just so much better than everything, especially what directly came before it.
Yeah, we're starting off tomorrow with Golden State and San Antonio. The world champion Cavs take on the Knicks, and then also Utah and Portland, and we'll of course have full wrap-ups of those on tomorrow's show. But let's do our predictions first here. I wanted to start, we'll just put each team in each conference in order. I will start with my top three. I think we're, hopefully it's not groupthink, but I think we're pretty similar this year, maybe more so than we were last year. I have the Golden State Warriors. I predicted them for 69 wins on my podcast with Ethan, and I'm going to stick there. San Antonio, I think, is going to be number two, 59 wins, and the Clippers, number three, 53 wins. Any thoughts on that?
I think 59 is a little rosy for the Spurs. It's certainly possible. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, that's an outlandish prediction. I think they're going to be a little bit lower, and while it could be close, maybe it's one of those things that it's more fun to put a little sizzle on it. I think the Clippers are going to finish second in the West.
Okay. Well, yeah, and we'll do our playoff predictions at the end of this, of course. I have Utah with 50 wins as the four seed, and then Houston and Portland tied with the next two, 5 and 6, with 46 wins. Oklahoma City, 45 wins at 7. And then, despite the fact that I said I didn't think Minnesota would make the playoffs, which I still don't, because there are a lot of teams that are right there with them, so I think there's a less than 50% chance they make it, but I do have them with 40 wins. So I do, probably unlikely that 40 gets it done for that eighth seed, but I just have, because I think a lot of those teams have some injury problems, a lot of them have variables or they could do a lot better. But if I just had to pick what I think is an average outcome, or I guess maybe a median outcome more accurately for some of these teams, I had Minnesota with the eighth seed at 40 wins.
I have the same four teams, but in a different order. I have Portland over Houston just because they have, I think they're a little bit less top heavy.
You got Utah at four as well?
Oh yeah, Utah at four.
I mean, even with 50 is 50 too much for them?
It's about right. I mean, I probably go high 40s, maybe like 48, 49, but that's marginal. But then Portland over Houston, because I think they have more defensive potential and their offense will be good. And they're a little bit deeper in terms of the positions that are relevant. Like, they can try different guys at center and power forward and do things like that, but it's not a big difference. And
yeah, then I think Portland, while we're talking about them, I think their new starting lineup is going to be awesome. That starting lineup looked great as we saw it in the preseason live on Friday against the Warriors. And I think that their bench, I think that the Evan Turner thing is not going to work. I think he's going to have a really bad real plus minus because he'll be juxtaposed with the starters who are going to look so good. And so I think that that's what's going to hold them back. I mean, I think if their starting lineup actually could look really good, and you know, whether playing Crabbe and Turner together, I didn't like the way that combination really fit that well either.
Something by you actually. So when I had Eric Gunderson on Locked On Warriors after that game that we were talking about, and I theorized that while I'm not sure Terry Stotts is going to do this, that what I would actually do is go away from a stagger and just play Lillard and McCollum together and then run something like Turner, Napier, and Crabbe on the second unit and just push your advantage on the starters and just don't let McCollum get dragged down with what happens on the second unit and live with that. Does that make sense to you?
The same approach that we criticized Doc Rivers for the last like 4 years.
But that's because Doc Rivers' team, you know, Blake Griffin and Chris Paul aren't necessarily simpatico in the same way that Dame and CJ are. And I mean, that's the whole point of a stagger to me, is that you use it when the guys don't fit together as well. Like, there's a reason why Blake Griffin can succeed in those circumstances that is different than CJ.
Yeah, maybe you say, all right, we're just going to have a little bit better defense on it. But if they have Napier, I don't think that helps much either defensively. I don't think that lineup is that great on defense either. So I would probably try to stick with CJ because he is good enough to be the primary impetus on the second unit. My solution would just be don't play Turner as much. We'll see. It was only one game. Turner was awful in that game. Every time they just didn't guard him at all. I mean, they're even coming off him in the strong side corner, which is almost always a no-no for NBA defenses. And they're still, and he was just mucking it up and then not even coming close on his three-pointer. I want to say he was like negative 18 in 16 minutes or something like that. But anyway, that's enough on Portland. But since we saw them, it's interesting to talk.
One other thing that I have a difference in is I have Minnesota over Oklahoma City, but that's not because I think Minnesota is going to be super awesome. I'm putting them more in the 43 range. I just think Oklahoma City is going to struggle a little bit more. So they'll still make the playoffs, but they're going to be the team on the border.
Yeah. And Zach Harper and I, of course, talked about them extensively on the podcast that came out yesterday. So if you want more on them, we've got a whole hour that came out recently. Number nine, I had Memphis with a projected 39 wins, of course, with the caveat that if everyone is healthy, they could really skyrocket up that and might even get to 50 wins or so. But again, with Parsons supposedly not feeling any pain per a Tim McMahon report today, but still not clear to start the season. Gasol's going to be on a minutes limit. He had a supposedly unrelated bone bruise, but you know, hasn't looked that amazing to me either in the preseason from what little I've seen. The Zach Randolph off the bench thing, their lack of doubt that the one and the two, I think that they could, this is one of those teams where if they make a move just to get another competent veteran or two into the rotation, that could be something that would really make them take off. But as of right now, I think they just have too many holes in their rotation, and I worry about them. Do you feel similarly about Memphis?
I do. They do have a little bit of disaster potential, but the problem is their pick is not protected enough to make it really matter, because they don't have that incentive, because they're not going to be one of the five worst teams in the league. So they're not going to fall into that. But
yeah, and it's top five protected, of course, from Bates trade years ago.
So it's so top heavy that's a little bit of a concern. But yeah, I think they're better than the rest of the teams that we're going to talk about. And the idea of them having upside raises their expected value more than, let's say, a team like Dallas, where, you know, Dallas could do better, but I don't think there's a real shot that they're going to win like 47 or anything crazy like
that. Yeah. I think like Dallas is a team where I feel like there is just no way they're getting above like 44 wins. It would be very difficult for me to imagine that, especially with Harrison Barnes having had this awful preseason. He shot 22% from the field in preseason, which was not too good. I had them at 38. New Orleans also at 38. That's probably the one that I'm feeling least comfortable about. I could see them getting bumped down, especially because, you know, AD had that ankle sprain. He's back. He had 33 the other night, playing like 37 minutes in a preseason game. His first game off an injury, not the greatest, but I guess he felt like he needed to get in shape. But he hasn't looked great in the preseason, as I talked about with Justin Verrier. So I could see New Orleans being a lot lower. That's kind of one of those stubbornly like sticking with your pick. I would probably maybe put them more in like the 35, 36 range if I had to do it over. And then another team I think actually has some pretty good upside is Denver. A lot of the statistical projections really like them to get into the high 30s, low 40s, but I have them at 37. That would be the 12th team in the conference.
I have them in the same place, but like them a lot. You know, there are a lot of circumstances, outcomes where they end up higher than Dallas just because they have more depth. I really like a lot of the guys that Denver has. And also, when you look at last year, remember, Wilson Chandler didn't play at all. And Emmanuel Mudiay, the first half of the year, was the worst player in the league. And he will not be the worst player in the league again. He already wasn't in the second half of the season. So they could push into that mix and become that real like eighth playoff team, that real eighth strong team. And so it's not the most likely thing, but it's more than possible.
Sacramento, I have at 35 wins, but 13th in the conference. And then, but I think they could easily be better as well, especially if they can just get something out of Ty Lawson, just something even approaching adequate point guard play. And despite some of the issues that he's had, he actually has looked okay in the preseason. Collison's going to be out the first eight games, but I think they're actually pretty deep at the other positions. They have some stability at coach, at least now. They should be able to defend for the first time in eons.
And they're deep. This is a team that actually has guys. And even if they trade Rudy Gay for more future assets, you know, they have Matt Barnes, Omri Caspi, Anthony Tolliver. They can make these kinds of things work.
Yeah. So I could actually, I mean, it wouldn't shock me if Sacramento made the playoffs. I mean, any of these teams, I think between Minnesota and Sacramento, Memphis, I would put in a different category in terms of their potential. Maybe even Minnesota too, if Tibbs can do what we think he might be able to on defense. But, you know, Dallas, New Orleans, Denver, Sacramento, I see all those teams is at a very similar level this year. And then Phoenix, I had for 14th with 28 wins. I might even revise that downward a little bit too. But when I picked that, I hadn't really thought about how many slots in their rotation really are going to go to just put players who have zero NBA experience are going to be bad. I mean, they don't have a single guy who's even average at any of the front court positions, and Bender and Chris are going to be complete sinkholes this year as rookies from some of the on-off metrics, I would imagine. So 28 for them, but I could see them easily being lower. And then the Lakers I had at 23, helped in large part by the fact that they have so much incentive with that top three protected pick that they owe to the Sixers, that also will result in them losing their 2019 pick to Orlando if they give it up this year. They save that pick to Orlando entirely if they wait until 2018 with that Sixers pick.
Yep, I'm happy you made the pick protection point, but the bigger takeaway for me with the Lakers is I think they'll play a lot better this year. It just might not translate to wins because their talent level is lower than other teams, but they'll compete on defense more than they did last year, which is an exceedingly low bar, but still relevant. And then their offense will look a lot better. So there will be signs of improvement, reasons for Lakers fans to be optimistic, even if the record is not necessarily as rosy as their future.
I was talking about the East in a second, but first let's discuss Blue Apron. What did you have for Blue Apron this week, my friend?
So last night I made an awesome Thai dish with chicken and squash. So it was kind of a curry, kind of like a curry stew, I guess would be the best description of it, with rice and everything. And it was fantastic.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really love about Blue Apron, one of the things that I've enjoyed recently, is the Mediterranean beef skewers. And we have a lot of new flavors, a lot of Middle Eastern flavors I've really, really enjoyed from those guys. And whether it's Thai, Chinese, you really have a lot of different flavors that you probably, some African recipes as well. So you really get to try a lot of new things. And if you don't know what Blue Apron is, it is a food delivery service that portions out all the ingredients perfectly for you, and then you cook them. It usually takes between 35 and 45 minutes to prepare everything. The ingredients are incredibly fresh. There's no food waste whatsoever, and it's really an outstanding service. It's about $10 per person per meal, so that's less than you're going to spend probably on ingredients, then especially when you consider how much you're probably going to waste by going to the grocery store with the food going bad if you don't eat it right away. So I think it's a much better option than just going to the grocery store. The recipes are perfect. You get cooking confidence, as you always like to say. Well, you find out more about them, go to blueapron.com/capspace. Capspace is easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. blueapron.com/capspace, and they'll give you your first three meals free, $30 off your first order there. blueapron.com/capspace. All right, you want to go through your order in the East, and I will comment on it?
Sure. So I won't give specific win totals, but I separate it into tiers because that's how I like to think about it. And the top is really just Cleveland, but because that's kind of boring. Cleveland, then Boston, then Toronto.
Yeah, I had Cleveland with 56 wins, which is a little bit less than their over-under, just on the idea that they're going to kind of coast and not really be pushed that hard. Boston I had at 53, although I do think that is a team that has a lot of upside if they can really put it together defensively and some of the young guys hit, and they have a lot of lottery tickets in that regard. A little disturbing that Kelly Olynyk is going to be out until mid-November still. I think that he's actually someone that they're really going to need on their second unit to space the floor because they don't have a lot of creators. And then Marcus Smart is out with a sprained ankle for a couple of weeks. This is the third straight year now that he started with an ankle injury, and hopefully this one sounds a little bit less severe than the two he sustained previously. But every time we think that he can start to take on more of a creation load and get to the basket a little more, he suffers one of these ankle injuries and has a setback. So hopefully that won't be the case again this year. And then I had Toronto with 49 wins. But yeah, I think that those are a pretty clear top three to me. And after that is where it gets interesting.
Yeah, I get a little bit queasy with the next group and really the group after that. But I have a line of separation between Charlotte, Detroit, and everyone else. And the reason for that is just that I'm more confident that they're going to make the playoffs than some of the other teams we're going to talk about. So like you can draw either a faint line or something there. This is something I talked about with Tim Bontemps on Real GM Radio. But those two teams, I'm more confident than not, will make the playoffs. So I kind of put them separate.
Charlotte, Marvin Williams actually is going to play in the regular season opener. He has a non-displaced fracture on the middle finger of his non-shooting hand. So I guess that means that he's going to be able to play by bracing it up. And Frank Kaminsky is questionable. And most disturbing to me, Cody Zeller has been out nearly the entire preseason. He did finally participate fully in practice on Sunday, but that bruised right knee, which I think actually dates back to that series against the Heat when you remember he was limping around, and apparently he never really quite recovered from that or aggravated that in some way. But it's going to be a while before he gets up to speed because he's missed the entire preseason just from a conditioning standpoint. And I think Zeller is really important for them, especially offensively, because if they're starting Kidd Gilchrist and Hibbert, that is going to be a rough offensive starting lineup, because Hibbert, I think, is just one of the worst centers. He still can bring it on defense. He's looked good in that respect this preseason. But if he and Kidd Gilchrist are starting, then they're going to be right back to just the old Hornets, where they're just trying to win every game 90-89 and just trying to stop people. And then they also, their depth on the wing is a little bit of a concern for me too. I'm not feeling as gung-ho about them as I was, but we'll see kind of how they end up using their guys, whether Lamb or Bellinelli can give them anything. And then Kidd Gilchrist's health, always a concern as well. Kemba Walker coming off a knee surgery and was just cleared early in camp. So a lot of question marks for them. I had them with 46 wins, but if I had to pick whether it's more likely to be less or more than that, I probably would go less at this point.
And I would have put Detroit over Charlotte if Reggie Jackson was healthy, but he's not. And so that he's such a central part of why they work offensively. And yeah, they can do some things with Tobias Harris, and hopefully Ish Smith can be better. But I think they're going to miss him a lot in this stretch. And there is no guarantee that when he comes back from this injury that he's going to be safe for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I had Detroit as a fifth seed with 45 wins and might knock that down just a peg. Probably still likely to be the fifth seed to me. Oh, I shouldn't say likely, but they're my pick for the fifth seed. With the Reggie Jackson injury, he, you know, it's probably going to be up to 6 weeks still until he'll be back. And they did claim Beno Udrich off waivers from the Heat, which we will talk to a little bit more later on in the show, but I think that helps. He was a better option than Ray McCallum or Lorenzo Brown. So maybe that he can help them stay afloat a little bit as but you know, he obviously got cut from the Heat, who'd really need a backup point guard. So if he that to me indicates that and they kept Rodney Magruder over him, so that indicates he may not have a ton left, and he had that broken foot last year. So we'll see whether he can give them anything. And Ish Smith in the starting lineup is it may not be too good either. We talked about that a little bit more before. The sixth seed I had as the I almost said the Falcons. Wow, that's watching way too much football. The Hawks at 43 wins, and then Indiana and Washington at 42 and 41 respectively. That I kind of see those three as another tier here.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have Washington over Indiana just because I think John Wall is going to be back a little bit, and I'm more comfortable with the way that at least their starting five works. And defensively, Scott Brooks will get them back more to what they were in the early Whitman years as opposed to the disaster that was last season. And Atlanta's in this strange place because I believe in their coach, I believe in a lot of their players, but they're not as deep as they were, and we still have questions about how it's going to fit. There's a great line of kind of logic that Mike Prada uses in the Real Jam Radio that's coming out tomorrow morning about how the Hawks defense worked under Horford and how it's going to have to be very different with Dwight, just because they're vastly different defensive players, and so they're going to have to figure all this out. But Budenholzer is an excellent coach, and I think they will.
Granted, one of the games that I watched them was against the Bulls, and the other one was against the Hornets without Anthony Davis. So Pelican. I may have thank you. Wow. I'm really not doing well here with the mascots in the last 5 minutes. So anyway, I think it was that could be vastly overstating their defense, but I think their defense is going to be good. Howard looks pretty spry. He was a force at the basket in the games that I watched. I picked them for 43 because I thought that injuries could hit a little bit more than they have, that Schroeder might not be ready, that the backup wing depth might not be that good. So, and just that point guard in general could be an issue, though I've liked what Malcolm Delaney has done in the preseason. So yeah, I think I'll stick with 43 for them. And then I think there's another line of delineation. I think some of these teams could break into the playoffs for sure, but I had Chicago, New York, and Orlando all with 37 wins.
I think Orlando's the best of that three. I would put them over the other two because they're going to have the potential for an elite defense. And yeah, their offense is going to be a work in progress, but they can kind of work through some of that. And they do have some talent on that end. And Frank Vogel should help them. I think that he will really add something to it. And also, Orlando is in the unusual position of being a team that is young, but might have some pressure to win now. So maybe they buy a little bit, and they do have assets. So maybe they aim a little bit short term, especially with Serge Ibaka's contract expiring, and add one or two small pieces to put themselves in the playoffs.
Who do you think has the highest upside of those three teams?
Probably the Knicks. I mean, the Knicks starting five, if they could stay healthy, they're quite good. I mean, they have a lot of balance. They have shot creation. They have enough defense to make it work. And you and I both like Lance Thomas as a sixth man for this team. And so, and Porzingis, I mean, if he can take a leap, then he could be, he should be the best player on these three teams. Like, he could make that jump, and that, or actually best other than Jimmy Butler, but the Bulls situation still.
It's weird. I actually went through that exact same thought process and was preparing to say that. And then I was like, oh wait, Jimmy Butler, never mind. But you know what though? I mean, Jimmy Butler, I think, is going to be worse offensively this year because he'll be playing next to Rondo and Wade, and there's not going to be any space. So, I mean, if you...
And Taj Gibson, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like Taj Gibson is going to start at the four, which, I mean, that's going to be quite... do we have a new substance that we can call the Bulls, a new extremely...
Well, I'm going to... My Twitter one, and it's going to be, is Quark Gluon Plasma. Like, that's just... It's like one of the most dense substance in the world. It was created, I think, as a part of the Hadron Collider. And so, yeah, that's what I'm going to use for most of the season. But we can keep keep doing science time though.
On every 15 and 60, maybe, you know, assuming this continues to be a problem for them, maybe we can just, you know, regale the masses with 30 seconds on a science lesson on some of the denser substances in the universe when discussing the Bulls. But I think the Knicks do have the highest upside out of those guys, and the fact that they're going to be running less triangle, I think, is good. Noah's health in the preseason worrisome. I think he struggled with the hamstring and has said basically that he feels pretty slow out there, so that could be an issue. Some of their depth could be an issue as well. Rose missing the preseason due to that civil case is also not great for them. But I agree with you. But I think Orlando does defense probably better than Chicago and New York do anything, at least from a likely standpoint. Then I moved down. I had Miami and Milwaukee probably in the next year. I had Miami with 35. Could easily see that being lower, especially if they start out poorly. They could just move into full tank mode, and Milwaukee at 32.
Milwaukee, it's weird because I'm down on Miami just because of everything that's happened with them. But there are still there's more upside in terms of just they have a Goran Dragic and Whiteside, and if those guys do really well, which they certainly could, then there's more of a chance to me that they win 40 or so or thereabouts than the Bucks do. You and I both really like Giannis and Jabari, but losing Chris Middleton is going to hurt them a lot just because they don't have any semblance of replacement. We'll see what happens with Tony Snell. But both of those teams could outperform it. Like, they could easily get into the tier, the next tier, and then outside shot of getting into the one above them.
I don't think the Bucks can, to be honest. I think they can. I think I disagree with you on that.
I think they can. But at the same point, you have to separate them right now because the most likely thing there. And Miami has greater tank incentive than Milwaukee just because of the way their obligations work in the future, and because they're looking like they could have some cap space, some serious cap space next summer, so they can kind of time this out, whereas Milwaukee is kind of spent out, so they might as well just push a little bit.
Yeah, Albert Nahmad made a good point on the Heat preview that we did yesterday, though, that they have some tanking incentive, but if you want to get free agents, you also have to kind of look good, and so at the very least, they want their young guys to look like they can be a decent core, and so if you get down to 22 wins, and the Heat do have a history of tanking. 2008, when Wade was out, then they totally shut it down for like the last three games in 2015 and tanked all the way up to the 10th pick to get Winslow. So they definitely are willing to do that when the situation warrants. But so that could push them down a little bit. But I think both those teams are a lot higher than my last two. Brooklyn, number 14, 24 wins. Philly, 22 wins, number 15.
I'd love to have Philly above Brooklyn just because I'm so much more optimistic on where they're going. But where they're going is somewhat irrelevant to where they are. And they have so many guys without much NBA experience, and they have a lot of incentive to just kind of tone it down a little bit this year and try and, you know, be better, kind of like the Lakers. Well, they'll be improved, but it might not turn into wins. And also because, you know, I wrote about this earlier in the summer, that the center trade market is going to be weird and it's going to be a little bit oversaturated. And while the Nets trading Brook Lopez is kind of like that scenario where they tumble into the worst record, they also have no incentive to tank because they have the swap with Boston. So yeah, I'd have Brooklyn over Philly right now.
Yeah, Philly. Jahlil Okafor is going to be pretty limited to start the year. Nerlens Noel, he is having a plica? Is that how you say that? P-L-I-C-A?
Sure.
Which is supposedly not an injury. It's just like a structure that a lot of people like have from childhood. But, you know, it is a knee surgery. It's hard to imagine he's back in less than a month from that, even if it is pretty minor. So that could complicate their trade efforts for him as well. They at least have Rashawn Holmes as a backup center, though he should be okay as Okafor tries to work into shape. But yeah, I don't see how this team is really going to get much beyond the low 20s under really any circumstances, especially with, even you could say, all right, maybe Simmons would have just been unbelievable, but it's hard to imagine he comes back earlier than maybe 2 months into the season. All right, so we've got a bottom three in the league. We both agree on this, of the Lakers, Brooklyn, and Philly.
Yes, and I think that you're lower on Phoenix than I am. I would have that as a separate group, and then Phoenix kind of more with Sac and some of those other, maybe Milwaukee, as teams that are better than them.
What do you think Phoenix's upside is this year?
I think they could be, you know, like mid-30s. I don't expect it, but I could certainly see it.
Yeah, maybe. I already said
you know that. How much I love Eric Bledsoe. Like, if he yeah. can, if he can put it together, and Booker can, he showed something to me when I, not only in summer league where he dominated when he was out there, but he looked good in Team USA stuff as well on the select team.
Yeah. And then I could see Milwaukee or maybe Miami falling down to that level potentially as well, depending on what happens. All right. So conference finalists.
Okay. So I remember that I picked the Clippers to finish second in the West. I am not picking them to make the conference finals. I think it's going to be Warriors Spurs. So the Spurs upset them in that. And then Cavs Celtics, which I actually feel more comfortable in Cavs Celtics than I do in the West side, which I did not expect before I kind of really started blocking this out.
I was tempted with saying that the Clippers could beat the Spurs, but I would be very surprised if the Clippers have a better regular season record than the Spurs. And I would also be very surprised if the Clippers have a better regular season record than the Spurs and then also lost in the playoffs to the Spurs. They have been prone to collapses on occasion, but the Spurs generally do not win when they don't have home court advantage, and they lose actually more than you would expect when they have home court advantage in the playoffs historically. Granted, it's obviously a different team now with Duncan gone and some new guys in there, but I think San Antonio to me is almost always a better regular season team than a postseason team, just because they play so well, they never screw up, they're well coached, they usually have a good bench. So I think they are going to beat the Clippers. I think the Clippers, their upside might be a little bit higher than San Antonio's if everything is clicking, if Blake Griffin gets back to where he was 2 years ago, Paul stays at the same level, DeAndre Jordan improves a little bit more defensively, JJ Redick repeats his career year, even though I think he's going to be 32 this year. All those seem pretty unlikely, but they're possible. And if all that happens, I think that maybe they could beat San Antonio, but I think it's San Antonio just seems much more reliable to me.
A piece of free advice for Utah: if their goal is to make it as far in the playoffs as possible, I would rather be 6 or 7 than 4 or 5. I could see them making the conference finals as the sixth seed.
Yeah, they've historically struggled really badly against San Antonio. I mean, like, they get blown out by 30 every time they play at San Antonio over the last like 3 years. So,
but now they have the secret in former Spur George Hill.
Maybe so. I think if I'm Utah, though, especially they're going into free agency too, they want to retain Hayward as well. So I think actually I would prioritize just getting the best seed and winning a series over a slightly increased chance of making the conference finals, because you have a better matchup in the second round instead of in a play.
Fine, be boring and less Machiavellian. Fine.
I had Cleveland and Boston as my Eastern Conference finalists.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a Celtics-Raptors series feels a little bit inevitable, and it also feels like it'll be unwatchable, but the Boston would have the advantage in that.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think I'm actually going to really enjoy watching this Boston team. I mean, a series with
against the Raptors, like, I just feel like it's going to be like a rock fight that the Celtics end up winning because they make a couple more shots.
Yeah, I like the Celtics to have a better regular season record, and I see no way that the Raptors are winning a series without home court advantage. So that's what one of my big reasons to take Boston. I mean, I think those teams will be pretty close to one another, so I shouldn't say no way. That's probably put it being too extreme, but I would favor Boston in such a series, you know, if it were to happen with both teams at full strength. But obviously, much can change over the course of the regular season, to be sure. And then I assume we both have Golden State over Cleveland in the finals. I had it in six, I was thinking a lot about the Golden State Cleveland matchup. And I think that Pachulia is a really bad matchup for Cleveland because he, you know, just until I've seen him really a bunch of games in a row here in person, how badly he protects the rim. I mean, he moves his feet okay. He's smart. You know, he's not bad in pick and roll defense, but just it doesn't even matter if he's there. You know, people just go around him and score. Like, he just cannot protect the rim. Also, in pick and roll defense, he can't really get a hand up. He doesn't have a ton of length. He can't get off the ground. His reflexes are slow. So anybody who's taking a jumper at the foul line is just going to be wide open when he's in there. So I think he, you know, him trying to stop LeBron or Kyrie at the rim, I think could be a big problem for Golden State. And they don't really have anyone who can do that. Not that Bogut was so good in these series against them recently, but they got something out of Azeli 2 years ago. So I don't like that matchup that much. I think that Cleveland, LeBron and Kyrie have that kind of flamethrower potential where they can blow up. I think there could be some tight sphincters at times for Golden State with, you know, KD feeling a lot of pressure just from having come here. We've seen that Golden State can kind of get a little tight at times, especially early in series. So, or late in series, actually, we might say too. But I do think the Warriors are winning. I think they have just too much talent. We were talking today, so you think it's Golden State in five?
I do. And if Coach Kerr plays the Draymond at center lineups less than 30 minutes a game in the playoffs, then I'm going to just be a ball of rage, because that's not only is it, you know, selling that team short, and it's not like I'm rooting for the Warriors in that sense. It's just that I like to see every team maximize their potential. And so I'm not as worried about Zaza Pachulia in the playoffs because they have a whole lot of other guys. And you can talk about how he is a flaw in that series, but Cleveland only plays one plus forward defender. You know, I think I would say they only have one on their entire roster, and LeBron can't guard both Durant and Draymond Green, which is what he did last time to great effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the difference here is that Draymond Green, LeBron switching that pick and roll. Now, all right, you can do that, but that's going to leave who on KD?
What I would do is just run. So you basically see who they put LeBron on and just run the high pick and roll with the other guy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they would put Thompson on Green, and then, you know, you can hopefully switch that. But then, you know, you're running into the problems too, where, you know, Steph Curry will probably be in better shape by the finals, if that's foreshadowing a little bit here, my opinions on him. And, you know, if you're trying to switch something with KD and Curry, now you're going to have Kyrie Irving is going to have to guard Curry. And then you're going to have Kyrie on Kevin Durant, and Kyrie is awful in the post. So Cleveland will have plenty of structural problems too, don't get me wrong. But I do think that they might be able to score better against the Warriors base defense. And I expect the Warriors base defense in general to be worse, both because they're just not going to have quite as much of a defensive edge as they have in the past, and also because Pachulia is not the defender that Bogut is, although I think he does help some in other areas and he is more consistent. But that's one opinion I will walk back on a little bit, that I thought Pachulia would give them more than Bogut did last year, just due to being more consistent. And I'm not sure that that's the case. I think he can still help, but just his complete powerlessness defending the rim was something that I was new statistically, but still have been shocked by in person. Let me ask you this. What is more likely, a Cleveland Golden State matchup in the finals or any other matchup?
Warriors Cavs. I mean, they're both clear favorites. And I mean, other than Boston, you know, like in the West, the field got weaker. And in the East, I think Toronto will take a step back, but Boston got better. But they're not necessarily a great matchup this year for the Cavs. So I'll take Warriors Cavs.
Yeah, maybe Boston can get better with a deal at the deadline. Maybe not, though. And I still don't anticipate there'll be a true superstar player that's going to make you say Boston is now really on a par with Cleveland that's going to be available at that point. Maybe if they got Jimmy Butler, you might start to put him in that category, but I don't know if Butler is going to be available by any means. So I would agree. I mean, and you know, LeBron's teams have made the finals six straight years out of the East. You know, I mean, it's like you feel like just picking two teams, all right, you should just pick the field. The math is smart that way. But in this year, I am not sure about that. And what percent chance would you say Golden State has of winning the championship? I mean, I think we talked about this earlier. I think it's probably about 65%. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I 60 was the number that was in my head, because what's so different is I think they could make the finals without theoretically one of Curry or Durant, but they're not going to win the title that way. So basically they need to be close to full strength in order to win it.
I think they could still win the title without one of those two, frankly.
It's possible.
We'll see.
I'm not sure I'd have them as the favorite, though. They would presumably have home court.
Oh yeah. I wouldn't have them as the like odds on favorite. If they got to the finals, I think I would. Yeah. So I guess that's a good point.
But so yeah, I think 60 is about right. I mean, they're going to be better in the playoffs than they are in the regular season, especially if they are more ruthless in their rotations this year. And I fully expect that to happen because there are some things they could throw out there that there is just no way for other teams to stop.
Yeah, Golden State is the first odds-on favorite, meaning they have more than a 50% chance of winning the title per Vegas going into the year in any of the three major sports since the Jordan Bulls. Wow. So that I think is pretty interesting. MVP, who are your... and for some of these, I think these picks are going to be who we think will deserve it. And if we think it'll be different for who will actually win it due to the vagaries of media voting, then we will say that as well. So MVP, who do you think would be, if you had to do a ballot at the end of the year, who would be the top five on your ballot, you think?
So number one would be Stephen Curry. I think he's really in line for another strong year.
I thought I was going to be different from you on that. Man,
you remember that I also said this last year. I mean, I just feel like he is the best regular season player in the league. LeBron and Durant, you could argue, are better players, you know, like at their ceiling, but neither one of those guys is going to bring it at the same level defensively every night. And Curry had one of the best offensive seasons in the history of the league. So I'm going to lean in that direction. And since it's most valuable player, not best player in theory, I think Curry's going to do it.
Oh, so you think he will win it in addition?
No, I think he'll lose it, but he'll deserve it.
Oh, okay. All right. So who do you think will get it?
LeBron James. I think this is the year the media narrative's there, that the Cavs will be good enough. And, you know, I'm that kind of thing can happen. And I've called it the karmic balancing of Derrick Rose winning the MVP that LeBron should have won. And this is a year, though, part of what it's going to be fun, even though I don't like the MVP award in the way it's usually done, is there are a lot of legitimate candidates. And I think as we get through deserved and, you know, could be in there, it's going to be fascinating.
That whole narrative that, I mean, granted, LeBron was the best player in basketball for a very long stretch, but the idea that he deserved the 2011 MVP, I think, is incorrect. He did not have a good year that year. He had his worst year out of any in, I think, that 6-year stretch, probably. That first year, his efficiency was down. Miami was not that good on offense. They had a pretty good defense. They're only like the 8th best offense or something in the league. And, you know, I think even that was borne out by the fact that he ended up not playing very well in that finals, that he just was not at the heat, the peak of his powers that year. I think that Rose, while he certainly had an overrated season and got some credit for Chicago's defense that he shouldn't have gotten that year, and also maybe backlash to LeBron, but Dwight Howard was in it too.
Yeah, Dwight, you could argue, make a good argument for Dwight.
I mean, and yeah, LeBron was probably, in retrospect, was the best player. When you win the four MVPs on either side of that, then it's pretty hard to say that's not the case. But to say it was like so clear cut and like everyone was just against LeBron, no, that's not true. I mean, if you look at the advanced statistics from that year, LeBron was not just like so much better.
It was a close call. Yeah. But I definitely don't think Rose deserved it.
Yeah. Well, in any event, I've just been hearing a lot of that lately, and I felt like I need to push back on that. So I think I agree with you that LeBron is probably my favorite to get it for two reasons. And this is just, I mean, it's kind of weird that we spend so much time on talking about what we think our peers in the media, who we don't necessarily agree with, are going to do, as opposed to what we actually think, you know, is going to be the most valuable player in the league. But nonetheless, that's what people do. And I think it's interesting. It's just kind of weird. So if the Cavs get to 60 wins, I think LeBron wins it regardless of how he plays. And he'll probably have to play pretty well if they get to 60 wins, by the way. But I mean, I think just as a lifetime achievement award, Curry, I agree with you. I think he is going to be the best regular season player in the league. But a lot of people, there's going to be a backlash with him because of just, even though he was hurt, people are going to say, oh, well, this wasn't real in the playoffs. He's not actually the best player. So fool me once, you know, unanimous MVP last time. Shame on you. Fool me twice, Steph Curry. Shame on me. That type of thinking, I think, is going to dominate. But I think that Steph Curry looks like he's back from what we've seen down the end of this preseason. I think that people were talking about Durant actually leading the team in scoring. Durant is actually like a favorite to do that, I think, by some of the betting that I saw. I disagree. I think Steph Curry is just still way better than Kevin Durant as an offensive offensive player, and this is still going to be Steph's team. I hope that that does not actually cause some friction on the team, but he's just so good still, you know. It's and I think that's, I don't know how many three-pointers he's going to get to, but I think, and you know, I think the Warriors, I have him predicted for 69 wins, so I don't think they're going to disappoint at all. I think he'll still be the best regular season player in the league. The rest of my ballot in terms of who I think should win it, Kawhi Leonard number two. I think he's just going to be such a force for the Spurs team. I think the Spurs team is going to do really well this year. He never gets hurt, and I like him a lot, and he's improved so much every year. I think he's really gonna, he had a whole summer to work on his game again. I think he's gonna come back and be a real force. LeBron number three, and James Harden number four, Westbrook number five. I think that Harden and Westbrook will, and I'm actually kind of intermingling the traditional criteria with what I think, but I think Harden's just, his defense just isn't gonna be that good. He's gonna have to carry such an offensive load. I think especially with Beverly out to start the year, Houston's defense could really struggle, and then Westbrook as well. I don't think Oklahoma City is going to be that good either, and I think his defense could be a problem. I don't see how he's going to be that efficient with the lack of spacing that they're going to have on offense. And I'd say Kevin Durant and Chris Paul would kind of round things out, I think, as the highest tier. And then Anthony Davis definitely could get in there too, but I haven't liked what I've seen from him in the preseason. He gets hurt all the time, and you know, if the Pelicans don't get above 40 wins, it's hard to put him in that conversation.
My number three, both in deserved and prediction, is somebody you didn't have in your top five, and that's Chris Paul. I think this is the year that it really kicks in with him. And I already said that I think the Clippers are going to have the second best record in the West. There is a very real chance he wins the award outright. And it's funny considering I advocated for the Clippers to trade him 9 months ago, but I think he has this year in him and that they could have some real potential.
Yeah, I think he's older. He could take a little bit of a regression. I don't think that much, but maybe a little bit. And Griffin is back too. I think they're going to run a lot more stuff through Griffin now. So I think Paul is not going to have the stats. He really bumped up his usage last year, and he's not going to need to do that this year. So I think that's, I would have him lower on the list. And I think you're going to run into the same cannibalization problems between him and Griffin. So I don't see him really being in contention for it. Maybe if the Clippers just go crazy and get over 60 wins, it could happen.
And then I have Kawhi fourth and Harden fifth. So pretty much okay. In line.
So Westbrook out of your top five.
Yes. Because I mean, really to me, unless you think Westbrook is this major difference maker defensively, I think Harden is a greater overall positive offensive force than Westbrook. And there is a difference defensively, but it's not as big and it's not as important.
And Harden's going to average a ton of assists. Mike D'Antoni point guards always do. I mean, Chris Duhon was like averaging like close to 10 assists at one point in this offense. That's just what happens. And there'll be this whole narrative that he's like so much more unselfish now with Dwight Howard gone. I think that's something that can happen. And you know, I think a lot of people really respect his game. He was second in MVP voting 2 years ago, actually won the players. So coach of the year is basically impossible. I think I went through the list and there are 14 people that I think could possibly actually win this thing, depending on if things break right, because there are a lot of teams that really have relatively low expectations, but some of those teams are going to hit and you can construct a plausible scenario in which a lot of those teams do hit. So I guess we can kind of keep it short here if you want to say who you ended up coming up with.
So instead of going with deserved, I went with prediction of, you know, how it could go. And the three that I chose were number one, Thibodeau, number two, Steve Clifford, number three, Quinn Snyder, partially because most people are lower on the Jazz and the Hornets than we are. So if they outperform relative to those expectations, then those guys will do well. And Tibbs will probably get the lion's share of the credit for what will be a massive jump in the Wolves' wins.
I don't see any way Clifford wins it because they won 48 last year and I don't see them getting there this year. And if they do, it'll be a win or two more than that. I don't see them getting beyond 50 wins under nearly any circumstances at this point. Brad Stevens was, I think, my number one pick. I think the Celtics, if they get over 55 wins, and he's a guy who's had a good reputation, has been perceived as doing a good job for a while now, I think guys like that can have a little bit more. I think actually Eric Spoelstra was my number three pick. I think if the Heat, after having lost weight, if they somehow make it into the playoffs and do okay and basically have Goran Dragic and Hassan Whiteside as the only players anyone has ever heard of on that team, I could see maybe him getting as well. Snyder was in there. But I think in terms of who it should be, I think Pop and Steve Kerr are my two
best coaches. And I'd add Rick Carlisle too.
Yeah. I disagree with you a little bit on that. We've talked about that before on our awards last year, but those are the two best coaches in the league to me, unless it is a deciding game seven and they have to do the substitutions. Both of them have had some foibles in that the last couple of years, but throughout the course of the regular season, I mean, those guys are the two best to me until further notice.
Yeah, two others I want to throw out there in terms of potential winners. Frank Vogel, I talked earlier in the podcast about how Orlando could be better than expected defensively, and D'Antoni, just because the Rockets will be fun to watch. And while they had, you know, the talent, they were the two seed in the West just two years ago, that sort of improvement without Dwight Howard and just everything else, I think that could get him in the running.
First coach fired, always kind of a rough category. Not a ton of candidates here because so many have either recent records of success, are on long-term contracts and are their own bosses, or were just hired this year. So with that being the case, my list was Alvin Gentry, Brett Brown, Fred Hoiberg, and Jason Kidd. And even Kidd and Hoiberg seem fairly secure in their jobs. Brett Brown seems like the clear guy to me, just because of the way the Coangelos have kind of not taken, shall we say, to the existing personnel in Philadelphia, and their reports that they were not particularly happy that it had already been reported that Brown's extension was done, or that Brown's extension was done when they arrived there already in December. So with that being the case, if they get off to a poor start, and with some of the injury problems, I think that's quite possible. I think he could be the first guy in the chopping block.
Gentry is the leader to me, because there are already the situations in place for New Orleans to be disappointing at the start of the year. Drew Holiday's missing time. Tyreke Evans is missing time. They just don't have enough star power around that. And also, just with the way that it sounds like their ownership and everything works, I could see them getting really impatient and just putting him on the chopping block.
You know, I would have thought so too, but I asked Justin Verrier about that on my preview with the Pelicans about a week ago, and he said he doesn't think so. He thinks that Dell Demps is basically tied at the hip with Gentry now, because Demps decided to move on from Monty Williams after that playoff season in 2014-15. So he thinks that Gentry is probably going to be there throughout the year, and then it'll just all get reevaluated at the end of the year. But otherwise, I would have agreed. And Watson, I mean, I guess he did start a new contract, but, you know, I could see Phoenix disappointing. I don't think he's going to get canned. I think that he might be kind of on the, just as a guy who doesn't have a ton of experience, not a huge contract, a young team that may not do that well. I think he'll be given more time, but he kind of fits into that category more than anyone else. And then Hoiberg, I think the Bulls are going to really disappoint, but I mean, he has like a huge contract, I think 5 years, $5 million a year. And he was Gar Foreman's guy. And if they move on from Thibodeau, fired Thibodeau to hire him, and then he gets dumped, that's going to look really bad for management. And Kidd, one reason I think for him, I think the Bucks are going to disappoint. And then also remember, he really was the impetus from a personnel standpoint to dump Knight, get Carter Williams. That obviously was a complete disaster. It has now been reported by Woj over the summer that they are not listening to him on personnel matters anymore, but I think that was a bit of a stain for him. So if they start doing poorly, then it could be some fireworks there. And Kidd certainly not one to be above a messy exit from certain destinations.
Ready to do defensive player of the year?
Yeah, I have Rudy Gobert number one, and then Draymond Green and Kawhi Leonard two and three. Just because Leonard below Green this year, just because I think that Leonard might take a little bit of a step back, although I did have his number two in MVP. So I think part of that was more just, I think the Spurs are going to win a lot of games, and maybe that's going to kind of pollute things more than maybe you would expect. But I think Gobert, he looks like a monster in the preseason. He'll be better on offense, so he's going to play more, I think, and that'll help him a lot. He's going to close games, and I think the Jazz are going to have just a monster defense, and I think they're going to do better than people expect. So that's all of those ingredients in place to me, and I think Gobert, those were not my top three last year in a different order. Gobert might have been higher if he had played more games, and so I think he was probably going to take it this year, because I think Green also, the Warriors might take a step back on their season-long defense, just as I expect the Spurs to.
I find your order really interesting, because I think Kawhi Leonard is going to deserve it, but I'm not as confident that he's going to win it. And the reason for that is he is the central defensive player now, and if they don't take as big a step back, you know, I think they will take a step back. They pretty much have to. I mean, they were incredible last year, and he is the unquestioned linchpin now. But Gobert is a nice story and all that, so I think Kawhi will deserve it and Gobert will win it.
Anyone else you're even thinking about being in this top three?
If Orlando jumps into the top five, then, you know, maybe Ibaka or Biombo, both. Probably Ibaka.
Because well, Biombo's really not minutes. Even going to start. So
presumably Ibaka will get the credit for that, assuming that happens and he gets nice block totals and everything like that. But yeah, Boston doesn't, we've talked about this in prior years, Boston just doesn't have that guy. They'll be a great defense. I think they'll probably be top two. They don't really have a guy to throw up there for defensive player of the year.
Yeah, DeAndre Jordan, maybe he, I mean, and you, we've, I think we almost have been too slow to acknowledge that he's actually getting pretty good now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas because him being a defensive player of the year candidate earlier in his career was pretty ridiculous. But now I think certainly at his top end, he's right up there with the rest of those guys. It's just that he's not consistent enough and doesn't quite execute well enough. So if just at age 27, I think this year, if he can get to that point, he has the physical tools to get into this discussion, I think, but hasn't quite been there as of yet. And nobody else really comes to mind for me at this point. I mean, maybe Hassan Whiteside is another one who could get in there.
Blocks.
Maybe not even necessarily from a deserving it standpoint, but because I expect the Heat to have some pretty good defense, at least when they're playing with Richardson and Tyler Johnson and Winslow, that because nobody's ever heard of those guys, that then Whiteside might get a lot of the credit. I think he is going to be pretty good too. So that he could be another one, but I don't think, just because he's too immobile, I don't think that it's necessarily going to happen. Sixth man, another one where there are just a billion candidates here, at least in terms of who I think is going to deserve it.
So I actually did my list for this because I thought it was more intellectually interesting in terms of who will like be in consideration to win it. And I went with three because there are three on the ballot. Number three is Andre Iguodala, who I think will probably deserve it. He was the best bench player in the league last year, but he didn't win it last year when he deserved it. I don't think he's going to win it this year. And then the two above him are both guys who fit kind of the bill of they probably should be starters and they'll put up counting stats, but they're not going to start enough to qualify. So that's Brandon Knight at two and then Jahlil Okafor at one.
Oh yeah, Knight. I totally forgot about him. He could definitely be in there. I mean, Phoenix might just be bad enough that nobody gives him any consideration, but I think he's going to average a lot of points probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's why I think Knight and Okafor, they're going to put up a ton of counting stats, even though they'll be on bad teams. And, you know, if Ja puts up close to a double-double, because he's probably going to, I mean, especially when Nerlens is out, he's probably going to play close to starter minutes when he's healthy, because Embiid's going to be on a minutes limit at least for a little while. So he could do that, and there isn't really the reason for Philly to push him into the starting lineup.
Well, let me push back on those two guys, because to my recollection, I don't think there really are ever six-man award winners on bad teams. I think the whole reason that this exists is a way to try to con players into thinking it's okay to come off the bench.
Fred Katz brought up almost this exact same point to me when I floated this to him earlier in the day, but I believe that they'll put up enough stats that it won't matter.
So I guess I would pick Iguodala just because I think people will feel bad about him not winning it last year, but that said, and he's going to get a lot of exposure. But that said, he's not going to put up any kind of counting stats. I could see his minutes being limited a lot more this year, too. You know, maybe he's only going to play 22, 23 minutes a game. But I have some other ones I think, you know, are really going to deserve consideration. Jan Mahimi, if he comes back, the fact that he's going to miss time is kind of too bad. Maybe he was more accurate before that. Zach Randall is one.
He's the other guy who could size. He could be like the more palatable Jahlil Okafor.
One who might deserve it, but is never going to get it is Biombo. Wilson Chandler, someone I think might be a little bit more deserving if he can get back. Sergio Rodriguez, I actually like him better than Okafor as someone who could put up a lot of stats on this Philly team, especially with Simmons out. And then another dark horse, Terrence Jones in New Orleans. He had a really nice preseason. He's probably going to play whenever Anthony Davis isn't in the game. And since they have no one else who can score in that situation, especially early in the year, he's going to get plenty of chances to put up some stats. I mean, they're even having him run some four or five pick and rolls. Like just the game that I was at, the preseason game, he had to shoot every time because they just had no one else when Davis was out of the game.
Jennings is another guy like that I think warrants consideration, but he also might start too much.
And Crawford, I mean, you know, the guy who's won it, what did he win it 2 years in a row or whatever? So
if they give it to Austin Rivers, I'm going to go insane.
Nikola Mirotic, another guy, if he doesn't start, might get a little consideration. All right, we'll be right back after this break, talk about the rookies. Okay, Rookie of the Year. This is maybe the hardest Rookie of the Year ballot that I can recall.
It's brutal because there are a lot of guys who are going to get playing time who aren't going to be super
2013
good.
Actually was really hard too, but
yeah, that year was just rough. But yeah, so I mean, you have guys that are going to play a lot that aren't necessarily going to be good, and then you have guys that are going to be limited in certain capacities, but it'll probably be better. So I like to look at it as most outstanding rookie, but most other people don't.
I think it's still going to be Simmons, assuming he only misses 2 months. I think there's going to be such a dearth of other candidates because pretty much everyone else in the top eight is not really going to play that much. Like Hield is going to be behind Etuan Moore to start the year. Jamal Murray, I think with Gary Harris out, could play a lot. I think he's going to be good. He could put up some stats, but Harris might even be back pretty quickly here. I had Simmons, Murray, and Hield as my top three. Maybe Hield will take over for Etuan Moore. For my fourth pick, I have not Bender or Chris written down here. And Chris Dunn, he's going to be behind Ricky Rubio. So I think just by default, it's going to be Simmons because he's going to be the only guy who's going to put up stats. And people will just say, well, you know, he missed 2 months, but now he's back. And then they're going to give him the ball as much as he can handle it in Philly. So I still think it's going to be Simmons.
Want something really fun? I think the Sixers might finish 1-2-3.
Yeah, I didn't even think of Embiid. That was foolish of me because, of course, when I look at these, I always look at the preceding draft and forget about these people who are eligible from preceding drafts. Yeah, he's probably the front runner, actually.
Yeah, I have him at the front runner. Sharich maybe second, you know, him and Simmons. It just depends on who ends up playing more. And then Jamal Murray is the other guy that I think has a chance to do it, and he's gonna score, he's gonna get buckets. And so I'm gonna go the Sixers finish 1-2-3 and then Murray 4.
Yeah, all right. This is what I thought would just be interesting: sophomore of the year outside of Karl Anthony Towns.
Yeah, at first I was really on the D'Angelo Russell train. I do really like him. I thought he looked good in the preseason, but Kristaps Porzingis was so amazing last year
looked awesome in the preseason too, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Like I was actually talking to someone from the Knicks recently, and we were both marveling about how much better he looks when, like, on some of the things that I thought were his weakness, which was finishing around the rim when it's not a dunk. He looks just much more comfortable. He's handling in transition now. He's doing Euro steps. He's just got nice touch, you know, from 3 feet away from the rim. I think that, and I think he's going to be better on defense too. He's gotten stronger. Like, he just looks nasty right now.
Yeah, so I think I'm putting Porzingis 1, D'Angelo Russell 2, and Nikola Jokic 3. Jokic is just great. I really like him as a player. Put him, I can't remember whether I put him or KP second in terms of Rookie of the Year, but I really like both those guys. And the Nuggets will be better, so we'll do that. But D'Angelo Russell can be the offensive engine for the Lakers, and while they still won't be good, he can be one of their real bright spots.
Yeah, I think it was really a five-way race to me between KP, who I have as the favorite, Booker, Russell, Jokic, and then Miles Turner as well. I think is really going to make some strides this year. He's going to have all the minutes that he can handle in Indiana, and could be, you know, if they have a good defense this year, he's going to be the big reason why, along with Paul George. So I think that just in terms of who's going to be the best player this year, I'd probably go with KP and Jokic and even Turner, just because I think Booker and Russell are still going to be so bad on defense and maybe not that efficient overall either. But in terms of just who has the most potential, I'd probably go with KP and Booker, Turner, and then maybe Russell and Jokic, that will be saying these are the people who have the most potential out of this class after this year, which is kind of more what sophomore of the year even is supposed to mean. Most improved player, another one with just a ridiculous amount of potential candidates.
There are, and in terms of predicting how it usually goes, generally it's players who are good in smaller minutes and then just get more minutes, and it happens. And so for me, the top three guys are number one, Clint Capella. He's going to play more minutes and in that little funhouse mirror of a D'Antoni offense, so he's going to get a lot of really easy looks. Two, Rudy Gobert, because he gets that defensive player of the year pub. The Jazz are going to be a lot better, and he's looked better offensively, so then that all fits in for a nice MIP case. And then my third is one that I think is being underappreciated in terms of this, and that's Zach LaVine. LaVine will be better defensively, which isn't always a big consideration, but if Minnesota makes that kind of a jump, maybe Wiggins gets credit, but he had counting stats last year, and LaVine could jump in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many. I agree with you on Capella. I usually try to exclude sophomores from this. I actually think that Kemba Walker could be one, just because he's going to be the only guy shooting on Charlotte this year, and it'll just look like he has more. This is one of those ones where I think it's more interesting sometimes to just guess what the media is going to say. Dennis Schroeder is going to have a lot more opportunity. I don't know that he's going to be that much better, but he's going to put up a ton of stats this year. He doesn't have an established backup, and he's going to run some pick and rolls with Dwight Howard. He's going to have all the shots and minutes that he can handle. From the deserving, I think Wiggins would probably take it over LaVine, just because I think Wiggins has a bigger ceiling still. I think Aaron Gordon could be a big one in Orlando, especially if Orlando takes a step forward, if they have a really good defense. The talk is they're going to put the ball in his hands a ton. Maybe he'll do that. Gobert, I agree with you on. And they're just a ton. Bradley Beal could be another one you would look at too.
I know you don't like to put sophomores in here, but Devin Booker and Terry Rozier, who's looked a lot better. Or is Rozier a third year? No, he's second.
Yeah, I don't think you get it unless you're a starter or like a bench guy.
D'Angelo Russell is going to get consideration because of everything that happens, but the Lakers are still going
to. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll just run through the list here. Victor Oladipo and Steven Adams on Oklahoma City. Porzingis, Giannis and Jabari on Milwaukee. Mo Harkless, I think if he starts to hit his threes, could be up there, at least for me, although he's never going to win it. Josh Richardson and even Hassan Whiteside on Miami could be one. And so KCP on Detroit could be one too if he starts hitting his threes. Kid Gilchrist, if he develops his jumper and makes it through the whole season. I've got even one more for you too as a possibility, not a likely one. Harrison Barnes.
Nope.
You know, he never would actually win it though, because since he already has that huge contract, no one's gonna be like, oh, this guy's improved.
He put up nice efficiency stats last year. Like, he made a ton of threes because he was in a perfect situation, and you know, a guy getting a big spike in usage isn't really gonna do that. I want to mention one guy who is on this list, even though him being considered would really make me angry, and that's Nikola Jokic, just because he played so few minutes last year that his counting stats were artificially declined. So people go like, oh, look at that big jump in points per game or assists per game and rebounds. It's like, yeah, because he played too few minutes. But I think that there will be some buzz for him, and it will bother me to no end.
We did some of these categories on our wrap up pods. We can talk about him again. It'll be fun to go back and look at him. Player who most beat regression, I think it'll be LeBron James.
Chris Paul.
At his age, 32. Yeah, I mean, Chris Paul won it for us last year, I think. Most valuable non-star. My thoughts were Gobert, MKG, J.R. Smith as potentials there.
I'm going to question Gobert because one of the requirements you set on this was that they don't get all-star consideration, and I think he does. So my two are Jay Crowder and MKG.
Biggest surprise team.
Denver.
Yeah, Denver, Utah. I mean, and surprise, obviously. I think we're going in terms of the conventional wisdom here, not necessarily our own expectations. I still think Miami could get there, too. I think if they could be just a monster on defense. I don't know if it happens, but I think they have that potential. Who do you think as a team just has the biggest year-to-year improvement in wins?
Other than Minnesota?
Yeah, I mean, Minnesota was 29 last year, so. But Utah was only 40. So, you know, if they get to 50, that's pretty close to
there, too. I think I feel more comfortable in the Wolves getting to 40 than Utah getting to 50 with Hayward being out.
If the Philadelphia 76ers win 22 games, as I have them.
Oh, record, crap, that's right.
They, in fact, would take this award.
How many did Orlando win last year?
35.
Oh, yeah, it's not going to be them then.
Yeah, no, they're not going to get there. Yeah, maybe it'd be Philly. That'd be hilarious. And they're still the worst record in the league. I mean, 10-72, man, that is just so few wins. It's unbelievable. Biggest surprise player?
Ronnie Hood. I think that he's talented. He'll get a chance with Hayward being out. He can fill a really nice role for them and be a big part of their success.
What about Dwight Howard?
Sure.
Yeah,
people have been sleeping on Dwight. I think this could be a really nice year for him.
Most disappointing team.
Oh, I mean, there are a couple real good choices here, but there are two that just I've been hearing buzz about them from, let's call them, more traditional news sources, and that would be Chicago and Indiana.
I'm going to go Chicago and Memphis. I still think Indiana will make the playoffs.
Yeah, I think they will too, but there are people who think they might like make the conference finals. And there's one other team, because I'm lower on them than most, is that there's a possibility Oklahoma City, like, even if they end up as like the 8 seed or something, I think a lot of people will be disappointed in that.
Yeah, people are thinking of them as like in contention for the fourth or fifth seed, and I don't necessarily see it that way. And most disappointing player?
Jeff Teague and DeMar DeRozan.
Ooh, that's a good one. I was going to go with Dwayne Wade.
I think he might have a decent year.
I mean, maybe he'll just take a lot of shots and it won't look that, but I mean, I think he's just going to be really inefficient. I think he's going to be awful on defense. He doesn't look particularly svelte to me early on in the season either. All right, last one. Executive of the year.
Bob Myers, done.
I agree with you. He will deserve it. I think he will not get it because it's just really only, well, I mean, I guess they got Pachulia and David.
Professional Price. Jealousy?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it, right? And I think it's also just like, oh, how hard is it to just like have an awesome team? And then, and he's already won it too, right? He won it in 2014-15. So I think it'll be either Danny Ainge or Dennis Lindsay who will actually get it.
God, it would be so, I mean, Lindsay did a really good job this year, but it was just, it was a culmination of a lot of different stuff. That would be frustrating.
But I think that's usually the way it happens a lot is you, it'll be the culmination, but you break through and you also did some stuff that year. I mean, the George Hill trade, I think is going to end up looking really good. They got Boris Diaw for nothing. So
Joe Johnson might start.
Yeah. So
to start the season.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We got to get through a lot of this news here, though. We're going to leave the CBA stuff for a future podcast. That deserves its own full future podcast. Stuff keeps trickling out. That's all really interesting. We don't have time to get through it all today. So maybe later this week or early next week, depending on I'm a little bit torn that I maybe just want to wait until it's all done. But I think once we have enough of a framework to discuss, maybe I'll even try to have another one of our mutual CBA Dort experts on as well. So let's get to the news here. Where would you like to start?
RJ Hunter getting waived and my heart being broken.
Well, it's actually, you should feel happy because if he gets picked up by somebody, then, but yeah, I mean, nobody has, the only team right now with a roster spot is the Bulls. They're at 14. Everyone else is at 15. But you know, obviously there are plenty of people who can be waived still.
Stauskas?
Hunter lost a competition with James Young. Danny Ainge had the quote that this, I think he told James Young that this is the first time he's earned something in his life to get the 15th spot. And you said you would have kept RJ, but it was by no means clear cut. I think that Young has a little bit more potential because RJ, I think, is always just going to be too thin and not be any good at on defense, a little bit too limited. So we'll see if anyone picks him up or not. In Portland, Shabazz Napier actually had his rookie option picked up after a nice camp as a third point guard, really kind of second point guard if you consider CJ a two. And I think he would have been a favorite to not have it picked up. Again, a guy that they got for nothing from Orlando. And how hilarious would it be if Shabazz Napier has a better season than DJ Augustin does this year?
Oh, Jesus.
It's possible, right?
Isn't that possible? Certainly possible.
Yeah. The Kings moved on from Jordan Farmar in their backup point guard competition, keeping Ty Lawson. And in Houston, Patrick Beverley is projected not to miss as much as 20 games with a quote-unquote minor surgical scope per Woj on his left knee. Woj says he's going to miss 3 weeks. You know what I think about anybody missing 3 weeks for a knee surgery. It's going to be longer, I think, almost certainly, or he'll have issues if he comes back that early.
And that coincided with some real surprises in terms of how they handled the backup point guard spot, because they cut Gary Payton II, who had a guaranteed contract, and they cut Pablo Prigioni, who had a guaranteed contract, to keep Bobby Brown and to keep Kyle Wiltshire.
Good to see Bobby Brown finally get a look in the league, a guy who's been in China for a long time, a scorer. I think he's actually someone who could be, D'Antoni might see him as kind of the Leandro Barbosa type, poor man's Leandro Barbosa type off the bench, and that he might be needed if they're actually, it looks like they're going to be starting Eric Gordon for now. In Atlanta, Jarrett Jack waived. He was never really cleared, I don't think. That is not a huge surprise to me. He tore his ACL, I think, in January, and he is in his early 30s. It probably would take him a year to get back, you would think, from that injury at that age. So he was never going to be ready, I don't think, reasonably, to start the season. They did sign him. It was non-guaranteed. And that means they're really only going to have two point guards on the team, Malcolm Delaney, who clearly won that backup point guard job, and maybe Jack will glom on somewhere. But I think, you know, he wasn't that good last year with the Nets. And, you know, after an ACL at his age, I would be very surprised. He's going to definitely sign on somewhere for sure once he's ready, but I'd be very surprised if he helps anybody.
Yeah, I think that's certainly fair. But yeah, there's this weird group of point guards this year that are all like recovering from stuff, but could be useful to teams late. Mario Chalmers is the one that I've been banging the drum on for seemingly months now. But there are a few of those guys that could end up helping.
Let's get to Miami now. They waived Beno Udrih after giving him a minimum contract that was fully guaranteed. Listeners will remember, of course, that back in February, Udrich broke his foot and he accepted a buyout for $90,000 less than he was owed for absolutely no discernible reason whatsoever at that time. That enabled the Heat to avoid the repeater tax and still have room to sign Joe Johnson to a minimum contract immediately. They would have had to wait, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks to sign him otherwise. And then, big surprise, he didn't have any other offers and he signed a 1-year guaranteed deal with Miami. And then Miami was so brazen about what very, very likely was a pre-existing arrangement as a thank you for taking that $90,000 haircut for no reason, they just went ahead and cut him. And, you know, if the league investigates this, and the reason it's illegal, of course, is you can't have future promises for contracts that all contract arrangements must be reported to the commissioner's office. And of course, if they had reported that we've already agreed to sign him to a new contract next year, such contract would have been voided by the commissioner's office. So that is circumvention. And while I'm sure it was all verbal, none of the parties involved would ever attest that there was anything untoward, the league just investigating, if only to throw a shot across Miami's bow to say, all right, this is getting a little ridiculously brazen here. And the Heat, well known for these sorts of shenanigans before, really rose some eyebrows for me. I mean, this isn't a huge deal, but if you think about it, the rest of the teams, number one, they lost out on a bunch of money because Miami was able to avoid the tax, right? Like, that gets distributed to other teams. And then not only that, but then Miami also gets to partake in the rake from the tax paying teams. So you lose a bunch of money, all the teams in the league do. And then Udrich, although he was claimed by the Pistons, had he not been claimed by the Pistons, Miami only would have had to pay the minimum $980,000. And then the rest of the league would have been on the hook for the difference between that and his minimum salary of about $1.5 million. So it really, the Heat, by these shenanigans, likely illegal, likely happened based on all the circumstantial evidence we have, because I'll tell you this much, can you think of any other reason other than this that he would have just taken that $90,000 haircut?
No, especially considering he didn't have a history with the franchise. Like, this wasn't a circumstance where it's like, you know, a player who's been a longtime loyalist, like, you, let's say Udonis Haslam or something like that, where he has a connection with the franchise. I mean, Benno had just gotten there through a salary dump with Memphis. So, like, there isn't really that sort of history there. And the only change I will make to what you said is I will change the word agreement to potential understanding, because I think that they didn't, like, formalize this, but that there was maybe not even verbalized, maybe just like a wink and a nod and something like that. But you're right that they should look into this for a lot of different reasons. But the most important thing is just to set a precedent that when you're getting really close to the line and potentially going over, that the league is incredibly invested in making sure that they don't do this, because the stakes are so high now in terms of roster management and all this kind of control that they can't afford this, like, kind of even perceived impropriety. But this is probably beyond perceived impropriety.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, what if the conversation was, and to push back against my own argument here, what if the conversation was Pat Riley or whoever saying to Udrich's agent, hey, you know, we're actually $90,000 over the luxury tax here. And you know what else is actually interesting is we really have a need for a third point guard next year. What if that's all he said? You know, I mean, is that crossing the line? You know, it's really hard to prove, but I think just to, like, and especially the fact that they released him, right? If they had kept him on the roster all year, it's like, okay, we actually legitimately signed him. We really believed in him, but they kept Rodney Magruder instead. And Udrich can still play a little bit. Like, he got picked up by the Pistons and Miami's off the hook for paying him anything. But yeah, I mean, it's just as a way to say, all right, you're getting a little close here, Miami. Like, at least give us some plausible deniability here.
Yeah, play the game a little bit.
What else we got?
Archie Goodwin. I'm sure certain people who are apparently Archie Goodwin stans exist in the world are going to be infuriated that we didn't talk about him at the beginning, but he just didn't really show anything during his NBA career so far. I mean, statistically and just when I watched him, like, he's certainly a talent, and like, he's a player who I'd like to see just keep getting a chance for at least for another year or two, but he didn't show it in Phoenix.
Yeah, and there may still be a team that picks him up off of waivers. Shams Charania's report on it certainly indicated that there would be. I think there are teams that maybe could use his skill set as kind of a poor man's Alec Burks, get to the basket, teams that could use some creation, try to develop him. I mean, the problem is he was so young that now he's going into his fourth year. He's actually extension eligible. Phoenix, I think, tried to move him, but as was the case with a lot of these players, RJ Hunter was another one. A lot of these teams that might want him are like, well, why would we trade something for him, even a second rounder, if you're just going to waive him and we just pick him up that way anyway? So once you start having those conversations for someone who doesn't have much value, it's tough to get anything at all.
Right.
And I think that might have been what happened with Goodwin. I think also maybe it was just a favor to him, a favor to his agent to say, look, we know he's not going to play at all this year. Like, just let him have his freedom. You know, his option had already been exercised for this year last fall, so he's going to get paid. So we'll see what happens there. I mean, it would have been nice, you would say, all right, just keep him around, and now we're going to keep him in restricted free agency as well, and maybe we could bring him back or match some really small offer. He takes a qualifying offer, and then, you know, he develops at the end of this year, and then next year, you know, you can go through all that, but they've got the guys that they want. Now, maybe you could say that if Knight or Bledsoe gets traded, he could have been valuable, but I think it was pretty clear that he like wasn't happy there anymore. So this is more of, I think, a human decision, and it's close enough to me. This isn't one of those, all right, you're really mismanaging the asset, because it's not clear that there was one or that they had the playing time to make him develop into one either. So I think this is one of those ones where kind of going more towards the human side than the asset management side is okay.
Which is unusual for the Suns. I mean, we've talked before about how it seemed like some of their moves were just like, you know, kind of marginal plays in that sense, but they, you know, made that bet, and here they did, you could say they did right by Goodwin in that sense.
The Cavs have cut Dante Jones. DeAndre Liggins has made the Cavs. And Liggins reinvented himself as more of a ball handler in the D League. He, you'll remember, was cut from Oklahoma City after a domestic violence incident in September of 2013. Only played one game with the Heat later that season, and then you know, has been toiling in the D League. But he has actually really upped his assist rate a lot. He's always been a pretty good defender, and he's hit 38% on threes in his D League career. So I think it makes sense. They also need help of anybody at all at backup point guard. And Liggins, I think, is a pretty decent fit next to LeBron James on the second unit if he can really get it together. Probably won't amount to anything. And then the other thing with the Cavs is a report from Brian Windhorst saying that Mo Williams is still on the roster. Mo actually Instagrammed a photo of himself getting surgery. The Cavs doctor and Dr. James Andrews, whom he consulted with last year, did not agree that he needed surgery. Another doctor, Dr. David Altchek, did agree he had the surgery. And now it's really the Cavs can't like fine him for not reporting he had the surgery. So, I mean, I'm sure Williams believes he needs it, but he also now, as part of this dispute, it's going to be a lot easier for him to get his money because he had this surgery. And the Cavs have not waived him. Reports are that they are trying to trade him and attach someone like Jordan McRae to reduce their luxury tax bill. He's making about $2 million this year.
Not related to that, but you know what team has a small trade exception, not their big one, that they could use to claim RJ Hunter? Cleveland.
Yes.
I think he'd be a nice fit.
Interesting. Oklahoma City.
Oh, Lord.
You want to get us started on this one?
When Ronnie Price signed, there was this thing that you and I were, I can't remember if it was when we were in Vegas or what happened. When we found out he got a guaranteed second year, we both went ballistic. Because
first of all, he never should have gotten more than the minimum. He probably shouldn't have gotten a guarantee. He shouldn't have gotten a guarantee more than the minimum. He got $2.5 million the first year, and he sure as heck shouldn't have gotten a guaranteed second year also for $2.5 million. And we thought, all right, he's a good locker room guy, whatever, like that's maybe worth the minimum. You noted that, yeah, he was such a good locker room guy on like a horrible locker room situation in Phoenix last year, so he obviously didn't help that much. Ronnie Price can't play anymore, folks. He was not a backup point guard solution. Campaign is injured, and they now have cut him and elected to keep Samaj Christian, who spent last year with the Oklahoma City Blue, their D-League affiliate, instead.
Yeah, and it's just a crazy situation in terms of that they also had Cameron Payne, so it wasn't like they had this urgent need, and they signed Ronnie Price long before Campaign got hurt, so it wasn't like, oh my god, we have to have a backup point guard. They didn't have the leverage. He wasn't good enough. You know, he wasn't good enough to exert.
Who else was even offering him anything above the minimum? Like, I'd love to know that.
Yeah. I mean, Austin Rivers said he took a pay cut to join the Clippers, and I want to know that too. By the way, anybody who hasn't read Dan Wojcicki's piece on Austin Rivers should read it. It's spectacular.
Yeah, I have that favorited after you mentioned it on Twitter right before we started. So Oklahoma City very likely is just going to stretch him. They have to elect now, and he won't break into there. He'll cost about, you know, 700,000 or whatever it is next year, or 800,000, whatever it is, for the next 3 years now. But just what a colossal waste of money. I mean, and this is, we're not saying this now. We said this at that point, that that was a ridiculous contract. And I don't think any of us even appreciated how ridiculous it was. It's not like Samaj Christian had like some unbelievable pedigree coming into camp either to beat him out.
I will note that it, I believe it's Samaje, but it's not a big deal.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah. Mitch, and they also cut Mitch McGarry, and that's a more justifiable thing. And our mutual friend Dan Feldman pointed out something that is amusing kind of to no end with Mitch McGarry, that because he was cut and suspended, if he doesn't come back to the NBA this year, he won't get his pay docked with the suspension.
Actually, we got to give Fred Katz that too. He actually texted me that over the weekend, asking if I knew what happened. And I did not know the answer to that off the top of my head, of if you get docked guaranteed money for a suspension if you've already been waived. So he's actually going to get to keep more money. And if he ever signs on again in the league, it's going to be very likely for a minimum contract. He's reportedly going to try to play in either China or in Europe to restart his career and get over some of the personal problems that he's had. So he'll get docked for 15 games out of a minimum salary instead of like the $2 million or something he was supposed to be making this year. Should we move to San Antonio now?
Yeah, another decision that, I mean, I don't really know how to phrase the Levio Jean-Charles thing, because it's admirable to fulfill a promise, but it does cost them money.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear that the Spurs, in drafting him, he obviously could have asked for a required tender right at that time and gotten this this deal. They drafted him in 2013, back after he had a great hoop summer. I mean, he used to be pretty athletic, and after a torn ACL, we talked about him on our summer league wrap-up show, that he just didn't look like he could do anything. No explosion, didn't really, you know, nothing that he'd done in France from a translation standpoint indicated that he was even close to an NBA player. So I think that this isn't a surprise. They had other players that they wanted to keep, including La Provitola, who's the Argentine backup point guard on their national team, so who apparently impressed a little bit in camp, and will give Manu Ginobili, an Argentine compatriot. So yeah, kind of too bad for Jean Charles. He clearly, you know, agreed to not demand the required tender in 2013, and they paid him back, and he'll probably end up getting stretched, you would think, too. And as I think the 28th pick, you know, it'll only be the first 2 years of the rookie scale that they'll be on the hook.
And he didn't get 120% either. I think he got 100 or something around there.
Oh, is that so? Okay.
I believe so, yes. I can check after we record, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah. The Grizzlies have cut Jordan Adams, another guy. And also, one more thing on Jean Charles. He is the first guy I can recall since Travis Knight back in the late 90s. Eric Pincus was kind enough to remind me of that one, who signed a rookie scale contract and didn't even make it to opening day. That is exceedingly rare.
It's happened 5 times since the rookie scale in its current form was enacted. There was a list. I can't remember all 5.
Oh yeah, I'd be interested.
Maciej Lampe, I believe, was one of them. Or no, Frederick Weiss. Sorry, Frederick Weiss. I got my...
Well, but Weiss never actually signed a contract with the Knicks, though.
Oh, so you're thinking of guys who signed and then were cut. You're right. That's even more rare.
Well, and I think the Bulls actually just renounced Knight because they just, you know, they had a championship team and just weren't going to have him on the team that year, and he was demanding the required tender. I think Weiss just, you know, they agreed that he wasn't going to come over, and then finally just gave up on him, you know, probably like when he retired or something. Fran Vasquez would be another one of those guys, first rounder, who just never played for the team that drafted him, number 11.
His hold is still on my cap sheet. I actually have it. I think I partially have it there just for my own permanent amusement.
Yeah, but I mean, that's pretty remarkable to actually sign, go to camp, and then be cut before you ever play a game for the team.
Yeah.
Memphis, Jordan Adams, they have moved on from him now. After his second year, he was guaranteed this year, did not have his fourth year option accepted, of course, and really sad for Jordan Adams. We've noted what happened to him before. We talked about it most recently on the Memphis podcast with Chris Harrington, but basically he had knee surgery over last summer, came back for the first time, played a ton of minutes in a row in that 50-point blowout against Golden State earlier in the year, had to beg out of the game, and never played again in the NBA after that. Clearly was brought back too early, played too many minutes in a row. Something bad happened there. So really too bad for Adams. And you know, if he had just been a semi-decent rotation guy at the two, it turned into that, and he was drafted the pick before Rodney Hood, then Memphis would be in a much better place right now.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, not only because he's a fellow Bruin, but just because the way that it happened is just disappointing, because he is still a talented guy. But you know, when you don't mess around with knee injuries.
Troy Williams, though, from Indiana. He was signed off the Sun Summer League squad, and he actually is going to make the team as a result of that. In Toronto, Jared Sollinger, my ears perked up as soon as I heard that he was having stress issues in his left foot. He had previously had an issue with a stress fracture in his fourth metatarsal that supposedly inspired him to lose a bunch of weight. He still, you know, doesn't look that svelte, and now he's having a screw inserted into his left foot because of those stress reactions again. And you have to imagine it's going to be quite some time before he can return. And that means either it's going to be Patrick Patterson starting at the four finally, and I think that lineup could be really good, and that's what they should have been doing all along, because Sollinger is just, you know, he's a center on defense. Or maybe it'll be Pascal Siakam who comes in as well. Is that how you say his last name, by the way?
I think so. I think yeah. Siakam's going to be the backup center. That's my instinct, is that they'll go that route. But can't we just for a second just pretend that it's going to be Bruno, just for funsies?
No, we're moving on.
Okay.
Devin Harris expected to miss extended time after the toe surgery that he had, and he's had all sorts of issues with that. I mean, you remember that was initially kind of what took him from being an all-star in New Jersey to being just more of a bit player, and then he had that three-year, $9 million deal. Actually, I think got voided because of that toe, and then he had surgery on it again. He's going to be out for a while, so it's Seth Curry time in Dallas, and Dirk Nowitzki has been very positive about him, and I think he's going to look like a steal of a signing. I felt that way so far, and hopefully that'll end up being the case for him in Dallas. I mean, Rick Carlisle will play rotation roulette with some of those guys at the end. But
And how ludicrous is it that the Kings basically could have brought him back for cheap and just didn't, considering everything that's happening with them now?
Yeah, again, another thing we were saying at the time as well. The Nuggets will be starting Nikola Jokic and Yusuf Nurkic in the front court. I think if you want to use those pairings, that's probably the time, is right at the start, because more teams start big than start small. Kenneth Faried will be coming off the bench. He has chafed at that before, but he's not the future of the franchise, and those two guys are, and they need to figure out if those two dudes can play together. I'm not sure how well it's going to work defensively, but I think they can really bludgeon teams on the boards. It should work fine offensively with Jokic's ability to stretch the floor and his passing. So yeah, I'm curious to see how that's going to end up working. And good to see that Nurkic was able to get back, and because he really struggled with that torn patellar tendon coming back from that last year. But it looks like he is, he played, I think, for Bosnia this summer and was looking pretty good in camp.
It wasn't on TV, but I talked to Adam Morris about the game that the Nuggets played against the Warriors, and he said that front line looked good against them and bludgeoned them on the boards, as you said, and did well enough defensively. And that's awfully impressive. And you know, it'll be interesting to see how it works out. And also just how Denver manages their bench bigs. Since Jarrell Arthur, I think, is still coming back from something, they've been playing Wancho and Faried as kind of their peppy backup big men lineup. And I really like that in the altitude. Probably less great on the road, but you can just run teams to death with whatever their second unit is.
The cap is supposed to go up just a little bit, $103 million from $102, according to Brian Windhorst. I expect that's going to go up even further when we finally get there. And let's see, do we have anything else here that we got to hit on?
No, I think it's because EG on Leon.
Yes. Yeah. What happened there?
He requested his release because he was buried in the rotation. And so he had this fascinating contract that was basically tiered unlikely bonuses. So he had a very small guarantee. And then the more games he played, the more he got. And I think he saw the writing on the wall and was going back to China instead.
Yeah. He did not look like he was going to beat out Tarek Black. Derek Favors may not be ready to start the season in Utah. He participated in portions of practice, but you know, he's been out for really almost 3 weeks now, so he may not quite be ready. Other news,
Danny Green.
Yeah.
I mean, so he had a left quad strain that's keeping out for 3 weeks, which, I mean, my first thought was, wow, is that the worst Charlie horse in the world? But I'm assuming it's something larger than that.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's more of like a pulled muscle. And apparently he'd been struggling with that since early in camp. So that's going to be an issue. The Kings are reportedly unlikely to reach an extension with Ben McLemore, who understandably probably wants out of there. And then the other thing we can talk about too, since there are going to be some waiver claims, anyone who's not making a minimum salary, you either need room or a trade exception to claim someone. And the teams that have room are Philly, Brooklyn, Phoenix, Minnesota, Denver, Utah, and Indiana. And then trade exceptions, Charlotte, the Clippers, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. So that's if you're someone like an RJ Hunter, Jordan Adams, who probably won't get claimed, Goodwin, you got to be one of those teams. Even those guys are at the end of the first round at pretty small salaries. It's not the minimum, so you can't just go ahead and claim him unless you have the ability to do so.
And who knows, maybe somebody will claim Ronnie Price.
What do you got to plug before we go?
So got a series of stuff. Real Jam Radio on the Southeast Division with Mike Prada and Adi Joseph. Locked On Warriors still going on strong, you know, previewing opening night and everything like that. And then League Pass Alert, my League Pass passion pieces are going to be on the Sporting News this year. And have a new piece on Kevin Durant as a scorer that's coming out on The Athletic Tuesday morning.
I have written close to 25,000 words in the last week. Six team profiles. I'm finishing up the Pacers just as soon as we get off here, and the Pistons went up today. Wizards should be going up, and then Pacers did the Central Division and the Wizards, so you can check those out on ESPN Insider. Also did a couple of five on fives on the Raptors and Wolves this season that are also up on ESPN Insider. Been fun to write, but it'll be nice to get my life back after this too. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Our sponsor today, Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace is how you get started with them. Support the show, let them know that you came from us by going to that URL. And we'll be back late tomorrow night with a wrap-up of all three opening night games. Cannot wait. We will talk to you all then.